holographic was first proposed and discussed by Tuft and Susskind in the early 1990s based on ideas on black hole thermodynamics. But the first precise formulation of this was Maldacena's famous ADS-CFT correspondence. So here, as you know, ADS is anti-de-Sitter space-time, the maximally symmetric solution of Einstein's equation with a negative cosmological constant. And CFT stands for a conformal field theory. So that's just an ordinary, non-gravitational quantum field theory that's conformally invariant. And the ADS-CFT correspondence says that string theory on spacetimes that asymptotically approach anti-de-Sitter space cross, in general, some extra compact space, is completely equivalent to a conformal field theory living on the boundary of ADS. So the goal is to use this correspondence to learn about the physics near space-time singularities. And there are both advantages and disadvantages to trying to do this. The main advantage is that this maps the problem of space-time singularities into a problem in ordinary field theory. Now, that's a huge advantage because we expect our usual notions of space and time to break down near space-time singularities. So to describe the physics there, you really want a description in which space and time are not fundamental, but emergent. And that's what holography gives you. The main disadvantage of this approach is that, of course, the world is not asymptotically ADS. So you might wonder, you know, how we could learn anything about real singularities this way. But the idea is to use this as a model of a complete quantum theory of gravity and see what this predicts for the physics near singularities, and then hope that this will carry over when we do know how to apply it to more realistic boundary conditions. Well, if you want to go way outside our Hubble patch and put asymptotic ADS boundary conditions, sounds good to me. Okay, so let me first give you sort of an overview or summary of where the program stands, and then I'll fill in some of the details. So the first model in which a space-time singularity could be described holographically like this was a model I studied with Thomas Hertog about 5 or 6 years ago. So this was a model of gravity coupled to a scalar field, and it turns out that if you modify the boundary conditions on the scalar field, ADS becomes unstable. So that means that you can find smooth, asymptotically anti-de-Sitter initial data, which evolves to a big crunch, a singularity which cuts off all space in finite time. The dual description of that is a scalar field, in a theory without gravity, rolling down a potential which looks like, well, roughly like -5 to the 6th. The field reaches infinity in finite time, and that's the sort of analog of the space-time crunching in the bulk. Now, that kind of field theory is not well defined without some extra input. The evolution requires that you put some kind of boundary condition at large values of the field. Technically, the Hamiltonian is not essentially self-adjoint, and you need to choose some kind of self-adjoint extension. If you take the simplest type of boundary condition, basically just putting a brick wall at some very large value of phi, we argued that we expect the theory to thermalize. The singularity sort of starts being basically one mode, the zero mode of the field, rolling down this potential. But as it does so, all the inhomogeneous modes become unstable. They become rapidly excited. And we argued that the end state would be something like a thermal state. And it would definitely not be a bounce, because a bounce would require that all of the energy in the inhomogeneous modes somehow get put back into the zero mode, so that zero mode gets shot up this potential and look like it was rolling down. Okay, so that was the situation 5 or 6 years ago, but there were several problems with this model. First of all, the dual field theory was really not well understood at the time. That's been remedied in the last couple years. The so-called ABJM model provides a dual field theory for the bulk we were discussing, but it wasn't known at the time. More importantly, it's just not clear if self-adjoint extensions make sense and are well defined in a quantum field theory with infinite numbers of degrees of freedom.
It is well defined in quantum mechanics, but there are various problems in trying to apply this in quantum field theory. Even if it does exist and can be made well defined, it may not be unique, and so there's extra ambiguity in the theory. So really the net result at the time was that it's just not clear if there is a well-defined field theory description of this kind of singularity. Now, there's been some important follow-up work on this class of models by Ben Crafts, Thomas Hertog, and Neil Turok in a couple of papers over the past few years. And I understand Neil is going to tell us about even more recent work later today. But I want to talk about another type of model in which a space-time singularity has a dual field theory description. And this is a model I investigated with Albion Lawrence and Eva Silverstein last year. I'll tell you more about what the model is in just a moment, but let me tell you that the advantages over the earlier model. First of all, the dual field theory is well understood. It's just an ordinary, basically supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. And although this model also, the dual description of the singularity involves a field theory with a potential that's unbounded from below, in this case, the potential is only a minus phi squared potential. And it takes an infinite time for the field to roll down this potential. So evolution is completely well defined. You don't have to worry about adding extra boundary conditions or self-adjoint extensions. The model, it's just a perfectly good field theory. And most importantly, the space-time singularity is not associated with the behavior of the field at infinity, but rather associated with the behavior of the field near the origin. Okay, so there's just absolutely no ambiguity. The dual field theory does give a well-defined description of the space-time singularity in this case. And, well, perhaps the main lesson from this model is a description of what is a space-time singularity in terms of the dual theory. And the statement is simply that our familiar gravitational degrees of freedom, the metric and matter fields that we put into sort of general relativity, are mapped into just a small subset of the degrees of freedom of this dual conformal field theory. And the space-time becomes singular when the field theory starts exciting all the other degrees of freedom that it has. On the gravity side, this is like all the stringy degrees of freedom becoming excited, and then the space-time metric, or a semi-classical metric that we would like to write down, becomes singular. So I just want to emphasize again that the problem of singularities now is no longer that our theory is breaking down, but it's simply a calculational one. Our dual field theory is strongly coupled. It's not easy to calculate, but it's a practical problem and not an in-principle problem. And I find this really striking because, you know, I've spent a long time trying to understand singularities, and usually, you know, whatever you're doing, you know, the approximations you're making break down just when things get interesting, or your theory that your, you know, model is sort of somehow breaking down. But here's a case where I think we have a completely well-controlled description of singularities.
Right. So we don't really have a situation where we have a sensible dual theory that describes a big crunch type singularity.
Well, you're basically right. This model is probably more naturally interpreted as a black hole singularity, although I will argue that in some sense it can also be viewed as a cosmological singularity.
Space-like singularity?
It's definitely space-like. Okay. Certainly space-like. Okay, so an outline for the rest of the talk. I'm going to describe the model. I'll talk about its implications for singularities. I'll mention some generalizations and then some open questions. And as I said, this is based on work with Lawrence and Silverstein published last year, and also work in progress with these people and Steve Schenker as well. But before I tell you what the model is, let me just remind you of a couple of properties of D-brains, because they're going to play a key role in the discussion. So it was discovered in the 1990s that string theory is not just the theory of strings. There are also extended objects, these D-brains. So they're extended objects in 10-dimensional string theory. They carry a charge. There's no force between two parallel D-brains.
The repulsive force due to the charge cancels the attractive force due to gravity. Ordinarily, strings are closed, but on they can end on D-branes. So you get open strings with ends on D-branes. And finally, a stack of N D3-branes, three spatial dimension extended branes, has a near horizon geometry, which is a five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space across a five-sphere. That's analogous to extreme Reiser Nordstrom having near horizon geometry ADS2 process 2. Okay, so here's a simple example of the type of singularities we want to analyze. So consider the following static five-dimensional black hole metric. So it's just the minus r squared minus 1 dt squared plus dr squared over r squared minus 1. R squared d omega, d sigma squared, where d sigma squared is a metric on a unit three-dimensional hyperboloid. So it has constant negative curvature. That hyperboloid usually has infinite volume, but we're going to compactify it by taking a quotient by a discrete subgroup of the symmetry group so that it has finite volume. Now, this space is locally equivalent to five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. If you don't compactify the hyperboloid, it is five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space in just unusual coordinates. But once you compactify it, it really describes a black hole. There's a horizon at r equal to 1. I'm setting the ADS radius of equal to 1. And there's a singularity due to the identification at r equal to 0. And it's really a higher dimensional analog of the more familiar three-dimensional BTZ black hole. So we want to study the singularity here. And to do that, it's useful to have another presentation of this space. So let me just start by reminding you, if you just take ordinary Minkowski space, you can look at the metric inside the light cone and write that in Milne coordinates. So that's just minus dt squared plus t squared times d sigma squared, where this is, again, the metric on a unit hyperboloid. And we can, again, identify points so that this has finite volume. And what you get then is sort of two cones. The past light cone becomes a collapsing cone, and the future becomes this expanding cone. Now, anti-de Sitter space can be written in Poincaré coordinates, in which the metric is r squared times the flat Minkowski metric plus the r squared over r squared. And so I'm going to take those Poincaré coordinates and write the Minkowski space in these Milne coordinates, as we were just discussing. And you can make the identification on the hyperboloids at each radial copy of Minkowski space. And so you get a space-time which looks like the one shown here. So let me just remind you that the full sort of global picture of anti-de Sitter space, if you can formally rescale, so the boundary comes into a finite distance, is just an infinite cylinder. These Poincaré coordinates cover a certain wedge in that space. R equals infinity is the boundary out here. R equals 0 corresponds to this null surface, the so-called Poincaré horizon. And T equals 0, this Poincaré time where the singularity lives at each R, is right there. Okay, so now the question is, what's the relation between this Poincaré description and the static black hole that I described a moment ago? This is the Penrose diagram for the static black hole, asymptotically ADS with the boundary on either side. And the answer is, it fits right there in the bottom half of this Poincaré patch. So the black hole coordinates cover this region. There's an identical copy of the black hole, which would fit up on top. And the point is simply that the Poincaré description of ADS has an extra symmetry, which is not made manifest in those coordinates, and its symmetry is the time translation symmetry of the black hole. Well, it's a time translation out here and a space translation inside, and it's really all the same geometry, just in different coordinates. Okay, so now we have a natural infalling observer in this black hole, and that's just a D-brane. See, a D-brane in the Poincaré description stays at constant Poincaré radius. So in the Poincaré patch here, this green line describes the motion of a D-brane, and that's staying at constant Poincaré radius. But of course, as far as the black hole coordinates are concerned, this is an infalling observer. It goes right through the horizon and hits the singularity. The picture on the left here shows the time slices natural time slices in the Poincaré coordinates, which go smoothly across the horizon, covering this Poincaré patch, and the Schwarzschild time slices of the black hole, of course, as usual, cover just the region outside the horizon and are singular at the horizon. Now, the natural metric on the boundary of ADS in the Poincaré coordinates is the cone, because you have the cone on each Minkowski Poincaré slice, whereas the natural metric in the black hole coordinates is just a static cylinder, where each slice of the cylinder is this negatively curved hyperbolic space compactified to finite volume. But these two metrics are conformally related. If you take the Milne metric for the cone, multiply it by 1 over t squared, you get a static cylinder where the new time on the cylinder is related to the time on the cone by just this exponential transformation. And the point is that one half, basically just one of these cones, the collapsing cone, is conformally mapped to an entire infinite cylinder. Yes?
But if I imagine not going out to asymptotic infinity but taking a finite cutoff, I have a CFT coupled to gravity. And in that case, I know that this Milne singularity would be a point of infinite blue shift, and so there'd be a large back reaction. And so it'll become a real singular curvature singularity.
Right.
And so I'm worried that if I think about my boundary, so and that'll happen no matter how close to the boundary I get, as long as I'm not exactly out of the boundary. So I'm worried that something goes wrong. There's some sort of the limit where you go out to the boundary becomes singular. You know, I'm worried that gravity doesn't actually decouple in the limit where you go out to the boundary.
Well, in fact, I like the fact that this sort of Milne sort of conical-like singularity is unstable, as you say. I mean, its slightest perturbations turn it into a real curvature singularity.
Yeah.
And that's good, because that means what I'm going to say is not special to this. It's going to, I think, apply to even real curvature singularities.
But would you agree that you can't really decouple gravity from the CFT on this background? Because when you say decouple gravity from the CFT, you know, you're introducing a scale on the CFT.
So our philosophy is things are not going to be well defined if you try to describe the CFT on this collapsing cone geometry, because the singularity is sitting right there in the space the field theory is defined in. So we're going to just work in this static cylinder frame.
But why do you think that you can then do a conformal transformation to get rid of the physical curvature? I mean, if the point, if you agree that there's a physical curvature singularity due to this gravitational back reaction at the Milne singularity, why am I allowed to get rid of that with a conformal transformation?
It's the metric on the boundary. So we are, I mean, on the boundary, we can work in, I think probably it's best just to stay with this. I mean, I use this as motivation, but you can really set up the problem entirely on the static cylinder.
Gary, doesn't the singularity go to infinity on the cylinder?
Oh, I'm sorry. Is the singularity to future infinity on the cylinder?
In the classical black hole,
yeah,
it would be at infinity.
But I thought this conformal transformation is the singularity at finite time or future infinity?
It's future infinity.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, there's really two cylinders. I mean, it's like the eternal Schwarzschild black hole.
Yeah.
I mean, the cylinder not here.
So you're not just taking that cone and puffing out the...
No.
Oh, okay.
No. Yeah, we tried that, actually, for a while.
We thought
of regulating it by making a little narrow neck, and we spent months trying to make that work.
Okay, I'm sorry.
In the end, we threw that all away. It didn't
good.
Work.
Good.
I mean, another brief comment is that the horizon that's getting inside the horizon itself is an interesting thing, which you could talk about before getting anywhere near the singularity.
Okay. So what's the dual CFT description? As I said, so
bulk space-time asymptotically approaches this five-dimensional anti-de Sitter across a five-sphere. The dual CFT is just the UN supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. In the Poincaré patch, the super-Yang-Mills live on the collapsing cone. And as Eva just said, that there's no problem describing physics inside the horizon before the singularity is reached. So that was a problem before. How do you see physics inside the horizon in a dual field theory? But this certainly gives a simple answer to that. But moreover, the D-brain that we want to use for an infalling observer has a simple description in terms of this dual field theory. The super Yang-Mills has six scalars, each of which is an n by n matrix, and the static d-brain in Poincaré coordinates is just described by taking one of the eigenvalues of that matrix and setting it equal to some constant value, say phi naught. And that value actually correlates with the radial position of the brain in the ball. But as we were just saying, we don't want to work on the static cylinder. We don't want to work on this collapsing cone because the singularity is sitting you, you know, staring you in the face. We want to describe everything in terms of the static cylinder. So let's translate that description. Conformal invariance requires that the scalars have a term which is an R phi squared term in the Lagrangian to maintain conformal invariance. And because our static cylinder has negative curvature, this produces a minus phi squared potential for the scalars in the static cylinder. It doesn't show up in the cone because the metric is flat on the cone, but we want to work on the static cylinder, so we have to deal with this. And the solution where phi just sits at zero is really unstable. Just a comment that it's in many cases, it's just the zero mode of phi which is unstable. The minite you include any of the excitations, the mass gets positive, overwhelms this piece. Okay, so under a conformal transformation from the cone to the static cylinder, the scalar field itself, you rescale the metric, but you have to rescale the scalar field. And so that means the scalar field on the static cylinder is the conformal factor, which was just the time in Poincaré coordinates, times the value of the scalar we had before. Before, this was just a constant. Our scalar field were just sitting at some constant phi naught. And putting in the fact that t is e to the minus eta on the cylinder, we get a time-dependent solution in which very early time corresponds to the eigenvalue being out near infinity. And as time goes on, the eigenvalue just comes in, rolls up this potential, and approaches phi equals zero. That's the classical evolution. So it's a zero-energy solution where the field just rolls in. And the nice thing to note is that this, I said, was just radial position in Poincaré coordinates. And the coordinate transformation between Schwarzschild coordinates and Poincaré coordinates says that the radial Schwarzschild coordinate is just the product of Tp times the radial Poincaré coordinate. So in other words, the scalar field in the Schwarzschild coordinates is, again, just tracking the Schwarzschild radius. So this indeed corresponds to the brain rolling or falling in all the way to r equals 0. Yeah.
When phi gets very close to 0.
No.
Okay.
Well, that's exactly the point. Okay, this is the classical behavior that you get by just performing. But there's lots of interesting things that's going to happen.
I don't even necessarily believe that gravity decoupled from my conformal field theory as I approach the Milne singularity. Because if I'm at finite radius, I know that the back reaction becomes infinite. And so I'm worried about the decoupling limit where I go out to my asymptotic boundary.
Suppose I never mention Milne, and I just set up this problem. Consider super Yang Milnes on the static cylinder.
And then I would say you're choosing a very funny slicing. In order to get
it's a very natural slicing. It's just like the eternal Schwarzschild spherical black hole. There's nothing more you're looking at.
But let me go on and then we can. Okay. So what does this tell us about the singularity? It's precisely because new things happen when phi gets small. Okay. So we want to understand the singularity. We don't want to sort of put a probe into a pre-existing black hole, which has already become singular. We'd really like to form the black hole from some sort of collapse. And you can do that if you consider a spherical shell of d-brains. Don't start with a single probe d-brain, but consider an entire spherical shell. And so that space-time of a spherical shell of d-brains, well, in Poincaré coordinates, the shell sits here at some constant Poincaré radius. The metric outside is the one we've been talking about, this ADS5 process 5. But inside, all of the stuff is removed, and the space-time inside the shell is just flat. Just flat, 10-dimensional space-time. Okay, so what does this do when you describe it all in terms of the static cylinder? So on the static cylinder, the eigenvalues, now all the eigenvalues start at very large values and come in. When the matrices are diagonal and the eigenvalues are very large, the off-diagonal degrees of freedom are very massive.
So they start in their ground state. But then the eigenvalues come in, and those off-diagonal degrees of freedom become light. And they become excited. And once they become excited, they produce some potential, which effectively traps the eigenvalues. And they stay near the origin for a long time. So this was described in a very nice paper on moduli trapping by Lev Kaufman, Eva Silverstein, and their collaborators in 2004. Now, there's a simple space-time picture for what's happening, which is simply that you start with this shell of D brains, and as it comes in, okay, so initially the open strings connecting one brain and another are very long, so they're very massive. You don't excite them. But as the shell comes together, the open strings which connect them become light, so they become excited. And once the open strings get excited, these D brains are trapped. They can't get back out again because they're being held in by all these open strings connecting them to all the other D brains. Okay, so that's the picture. And since the super Yang Mills is strongly coupled, the picture you get is that you create a very complicated excited state involving all n squared degrees of freedom in the Yang Mills theory near the singularity. You can argue that locality probably breaks down because away from the singularity, we were measuring locality in the radial direction by the scalar eigenvalue, but near the singularity, all the eigenvalues interact strongly with all the off-diagonal modes and with each other. The D-brain probes are no longer any good definition of a geometry. No other probe that we could think of gives any sort of sensible locality in this region. So I think locality just breaks down. Now, if n is infinite, okay, that means that there's basically an infinite number of strings that can attach one D-brain to any of the others. The D-brain can get back out again only if all those open strings suddenly annihilate and leaves it sort of unbound. And then this minus phi squared potential will cause the brain to roll back out again. If n is infinite, the probability that all of them will suddenly at some point, you know, annihilate and leave the D brain free is zero. And so the eigenvalues will be trapped forever. And that describes the formation of a classical black hole. I'll remind you that n equals infinity in this ADS-CFT correspondence is the classical gravity limit. So that fits. Now, if n is large but finite, the eigenvalues will be trapped for a long time, but eventually they will roll back out again. And you can calculate the time scale for them to roll back out, and you get a time which is e to the some constant times n. And this is the times for Hawking evaporation of D brains from the black hole. Now, you might be puzzled by this. This is a very long time compared to the ordinary evaporation of a Schwarzschild black hole, say, in asymptotically flat space. But the point is that, so finite n means quantum gravity is important. I said that, so this includes the quantum effects when n's finite. And the point is that hyperbolic black holes have positive specific heat. So without the D brain emission that I'm talking about here, these black holes would be stable. They would reach equilibrium with their Hawking radiation and just, they wouldn't evaporate. So this is a longer time, but this is the time for the actual sort of D brains, the charged object which formed it, to Hawking evaporate, and it's finite. It's shorter than the Poincaré recurrence time. Yes, Steve?
Do you understand this in the limit far away from BPS large velocity, or just in the near BPS limit? Problem with the collapsing shell.
We understand it best. Okay, so near BPS means this sort of near ABS5 region.
The velocity of the shell, I guess, is one way of thinking about it. It's a small velocity, small incoming velocity, or large.
We think qualitatively it'll be the same. I mean, in the generalization, I'm going to talk about other black holes where you send the shell in with different energies. And we think that the picture is qualitatively the same. Okay. All right, so this is the picture of the black hole evaporates with these D brains finally coming out. So first of all, the evolution is perfectly non-singular. The D brains, the field theory
describes the shell coming in, thermalizing or whatever it does, and then the brains rolling out. In fact, this is perfect timing for Steve's question. What about sending, this was this case where you sent the shell in with exactly zero energy, but what if you do something else? Well, first of all, the hyperbolic black hole that I started with has a natural generalization where you include a mass parameter. It's five dimensions, so it goes like some mass parameter mu over r squared, and so the metric otherwise looks the same. And now there are three regimes. These hyperbolic black holes have the strange property that the horizon exists even when the mass parameter is negative, provided it's not too negative. So first of all, you can take mu positive, and that's the usual Schwarzschild-like black hole with a space-like singularity. Even mu equals zero, as we said, has a space-like singularity. If mu is between zero and minus a quarter in these ADS units, there is still a horizon, but the black hole now has a time-like singularity. And finally, if mu is less than minus a quarter, this space-time doesn't have a horizon and just describes a naked time-like singularity. So these cases are nicely correlated with the possible energy of the incoming shell of D-brains or with the scalar eigenvalues in the field theory. So remember, we have a potential for phi, which is just minus phi squared. And so if you send the shell in with very negative energy, it will bounce at such a large radius that the off-diagonal nodes never get excited. Not only don't they get excited, they don't even have any sort of quantum effects in the effective motion of the shell. Their one-loop contributions are negligible. So there's some energy here, E extremal, which corresponds to just calculated in the field theory, and this is the energy such that if you send the shell in with less energy than that, the motion really is classical. It comes in, bounces off the potential, and goes back out. Then there's this regime where, for energy bigger than this, the classical evolution is modified by quantum corrections coming from these off-diagonal modes appearing in virtual loops, say. And finally, you could imagine sending the shell in with positive energy. You know, classically, it looks like the shell is just going to go crashing right through phi equals zero and emerge on the other side. But we've already said that's not what happens. There's a lot of new physics. All these, you know, off-diagonal modes become excited. The eigenvalues get trapped. They stay there a long time. All of that. Okay, but the point is that these three behaviors of the field theory are nicely correlated with the three classical spacetimes we have for the geometry. So if you send in the shell with very low energy, it bounces. And so in particular, you can't violate cosmic censorship. You can't form the naked singularity because inside the shell, the spacetime is flat. Outside, the shell bounces. In this intermediate regime, you can send the shell in. The quantum effects become important. And it bounces, and this is a positive mass regime. And I think I forgot to say that the important point was right here, that this energy that you calculate in the field theory, where this, which is the boundary when the quantum effects of these off-diagonal modes become important, is of the same order as the boundary where you start to form a horizon, the difference between the naked singularity and the black hole case is right there. So.
Same scale?
Well, let's see. So in the case we talked about first was sort of the m equals, or the mu equals zero case, which looked like this. There was no problem in this description with the shell coming in through the horizon, and the breakdown locality was near the singularity. Okay, so let me mention now a couple of the open questions we've been thinking about recently. The description I gave of the singularity is that, you know, the shell comes in, all the off-diagonal modes become excited, and you get some highly excited state with everything. That sounds very similar to what people used to say was the description of the outside Schwarzschild observer. The person who stays outside the horizon throws something toward the black hole, and basically it falls in and thermalizes. And so a question is, what's the difference in the CFT between the state describing the singularity from the thermal state seen by the usual observers that stay outside the horizon?
Gary, there must be a very large discrepancy of time scales in those two fields.
What, you mean because of the time it takes to go from the horizon to the singularity?
for example, that's finite.
Not, it's finite proper time.
Yeah.
But in these two coordinates that we're using,
it's enormously stretched.
They both infinite. So what I'm saying is that it's infinite for proportional time to approach the horizon, and it's also infinite in this natural time. We want the times to agree on the field theory. So the whole idea is that we have a field theory on a static cylinder, and it has some time which goes to infinity, and we want the time slices at infinity just to be extended in two different ways.
Okay.
So according to the classical picture, the slices which approach the singularity, again, have a time which goes to infinity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we also wanted a signal of the singularity in the dual field theory. We wanted an observable, a quantity which, at least in the limit of infinite n, where things became classical, would diverge, showing the sort of classical singularity. And then we could see, okay, when does it become finite? Does it become finite perturbative when you include perturbative 1 over n corrections or something like that? And then finally, a question that Steve Shanker kept asking, why doesn't the D-brain feel the thermal effects that all the other observables that you see outside feel? I mean, how does it manage to crash through this thermal haze unaffected? All right, so let me give you what we know about those issues. So first of all, the first one. I mean, from the bulk, this is a very strange question. The singularity looks nothing like the horizon. If the horizon is way out there, some null surface of singularity is space-like, things look very different. Why should they be at all similar? But of course, we said the field theory seems to be describing them in similar ways. So we looked at this in more detail, and we found that they really do behave similarly, in the sense that if you look at the dynamics of the eigenvalues as they come in, so that's described by the so-called DBI action of the brain in the bulk. You can find that, the usual in Schwarzschild coordinates, the position of the D brain approaches the horizon exponentially. It goes like e to the minus 4 pi times the temperature of the black hole times the Schwarzschild time. And then if you do the same calculation in these Poincaré coordinates, you find that the brain approaches the singularity also exponentially slowly, e to the minus 2 pi t times time. So there's just a sort of factor of two difference in the dynamics of how the brain is approaching this. And of course, this exponential decay is characteristic of some sort of thermalization process. So it looks like things are rather similar in the two descriptions. You can say, this was for the simple brain where you don't do anything to it. If you put flux on the brain, if you excite the brain, it doesn't change anything. This leading order behavior is the same, and you just get corrections at subleading order. So at least in terms of the dynamics of these probes, these brains coming in, it does look rather similar from the field theory.
Formal transformation to the field theory on the phone.
Okay.
So any quantity you can map by conformal transformation. I'm not sure I understand intuitively what you're trying to get at. But when you say, how does the state differ? Well, it differs by conformal transformation.
It's more than that. Because you're doing something more than just conformally transforming so the way to say it is, stick on the static cylinder. Don't do any conformal transformation. There are two possible time slices in the bulk, which both agree at infinity. One is the Schwarzschild time slice, and one of these Poincaré time slices, which smoothly go across the horizon. So one observable is evolving in the Poincaré time slice. The other observable is evolving in the Schwarzschild time slice.
The field theory doesn't know which one it's describing.
Good question. So it does know.
They're generated by different Hamiltonians in the field theory.
Well, close. It's related to it. Okay. So what we found was that, sort of obvious. How do we distinguish them in the bulk? In the bulk, you have to do a coordinate transformation in which the Schwarzschild time, or the good time, that the Poincaré time is equal to the Schwarzschild time plus some function of radius. That's the coordinate transformation which takes one time slice to another. In the field theory, that radial variable is the scalar eigenvalue. So what you want to do is a time reparametrization in your field theory, which depends on your scalar eigenvalue. So you have to do a field-dependent time reparametrization to go from one observable to the next. And so that's, in the field theory language, what's really different between these observables. Okay, well, let me now comment on the second issue. What's the singularity, what's the observable which signals the singularity in the dual field theory? Okay, so we thought a lot about this, and well, there's sort of an obvious thing to try to, you know, capitalize on. One key difference between the horizon and the singularity is simply the volume of your, you know, space-like surfaces, these hyperboloids. A constant r and constant t, they have some volume, which is very big at infinity, finite at the horizon, and goes to zero at the singularity. So what you'd like to do is to take, say, the frequency of some fluctuation of the d-brain. The d-brain starts off wrapping the hyperboloid, just falling in radial direction, and we had first thought about just the unexcited brain, but you can put some momentum on that. You can add some excitation to the brain, and clearly, when the volume is finite, that frequency will be finite, and when the volume shrinks to zero near the singularity, that frequency should become infinite. Well, that by itself doesn't work because of redshifting effects, because of the fact that it still takes an infinite time to reach the horizon and an infinite time to reach the singularity in these descriptions. So you don't see the difference clearly if you just look at the frequency. But you can get rid of the redshifting by taking a ratio. And so you can avoid the redshifting by, well, so one possibility is just take the quotient of our phi sphere by some discrete group. And then you consider an open string attached to the d-brain, which wraps once around this S5 mod Zn, and then comes back to the d-brain. Now, the S5 have constant radius all throughout the space. It's just a product of this black hole and the Sn. And so this string has some fixed length. And so its oscillations will then have a frequency which is constant in proper time. And so the observable that we'd like to focus on is now a ratio of this frequency associated with adding momentum to the d-brain, letting it fluctuate a little bit, over this frequency omega 5 coming from the string wrapped around the phi sphere. That's an observable which, first of all, is well-defined in the gauge theory, since we know in the gauge theory how to put momentum on the brain and how to describe these winding strings when you do the quotient. And second of all, should, at least in the large end limit, go to a singularity, become infinite at the singularity. So what we'd like to do is to calculate this, maybe at weak coupling, see if there's an assign of the singularity, see if it goes away at finite. Anyway, so that's something we're working on. Finally, I said, why doesn't the d-brain feel the thermal effects?
Short answer is we still don't know. My intuition is that it should be analogous to Rindler space somehow. Somehow our, well, in the bulk, it clearly is analogous to Rindler space. I think the black hole in the bulk, the usual Schwarzschild coordinates are really accelerated observers. Those are like a boost symmetry. The d-brain is following something more like an inertial trajectory. So the bulk descriptions are clearly Rindler-like, but now we're mapping it to a field theory where there's no Rindler horizon. And the radial direction is some energy scale, so we need some sort of Rindler transformation involving energy. I don't know. I'm out of time, fortunately, so I don't need to say any more about that. So let me close by just what I said earlier. The main lesson to take away is we now understand a singularity in space-time is simply a place where the other degrees of freedom in the full quantum gravity that are not the sort of low-energy classical GR degrees of freedom are becoming excited. They're all well described by this dual field theory. And we now have a framework to study singularities, which is in principle well defined, and we just need to do some hard calculations. Thank you.
Sir, before lunch, there's time for just one question.
We have a framework to study singularities that are behind horizons.
Okay, but I would say that if you go back, like I kept saying, don't worry about the collapsing cone. But in the collapsing cone picture, the singularity in the Poincaré, you know, description really looks like a cosmological singularity. It does look like it's going all the way out to infinity. But you're right, I think it's more natural to think of this as a classical singularity. But it is space-like.
Okay, so let's thank Gary again.